This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Okay, so the second thing, we decided to put a presentation together regarding independent living and a number of stuff of related matters. And we'll just start off quick with Charlene Jean Fortune from the Brevard office.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to be talking about extended foster care. First, what is extended foster care? It gives eligible young adults the option of remaining in foster care until they turn 21 or until the age of 22 if they have a disability. It's the automatic extension of the court's jurisdiction, so you don't need to file a separate petition. Under extended foster care, a young adult may choose to remain in their licensed foster home or choose some other supporting living arrangement with the approval of their community-based care agency while finishing secondary school, adult education, or entering the workforce. Eligible young adults may also choose extended foster care while pursuing post-secondary education. With extended foster care, the young adult still has the benefit of continued involvement of case management, case planning, transition planning, assistance with developing life skills, and judicial oversight. The requirements for extended foster care are in 39.6251. A young adult is eligible for extended foster care if he or she is living in licensed foster care on his or her 18th birthday, if the young adult is in the legal custody of the department on his or her 18th birthday but living away from licensed care, for example, in a residential treatment facility or DJJ or on runaway status, the young adult is still considered to be in living in licensed foster care. So in addition to living in licensed foster care, the child must also be in one of these other qualifying events. Enrolled in or attending high school, or working towards a GED or its equivalent, or enrolled in an institution that provides post-secondary or vocational education, or working at least 80 hours per month, or participating in another activity designed to promote or remove barriers to employment, or unable to participate in any of the above activities due to a documented disability, which can be a physical, intellectual, emotional, or psychiatric condition. Documentation can be in the case file, school or medical record, and it must be a condition that impairs the ability to perform one or more life activities. A young adult may change qualifying activities and remain in extended foster care. So they can stop attending high school but get a job and work the at least 80 hours per month. A change in the qualifying activity does not require a new application, but it does require the designated staff and the young adult's transition plan and may require the designated staff to amend the case plan. To be in extended foster care, the young adult must live in a supervised living setting that is approved by the department or the community-based care lead agency. The supervised living environment can be foster care, a dorm room, shared housing, apartment, or other housing arrangement, as long as that arrangement is approved by the CBC lead agency and the young adult also agrees with that living arrangement. The young adult may continue to reside in the foster home or group home that he or she was residing in when he or she turned 18 if that foster or group home agrees. 24-hour supervision is not required, but 24-hour crisis intervention and support must be available. The ongoing requirements for the child to stay in the extended foster care program, he or she must meet with their independent living caseworker every month and continue to participate in at least one of the previously mentioned activities and attend court reviews every 6 months. When a young adult no longer meets the eligibility requirements, he or she is discharged from the extended foster care program. Eligibility for extended foster care ends on the earliest of these events by operation of law when the young adult reaches age 21 or in the case of a young adult with a documented disability, age 22. The young adult leaves care to live in a permanent home consistent with his or her permanency plan, maybe the child gets adopted, or when the young adult chooses to leave. Leaving extended foster care voluntarily requires that the court verify that that's actually the child's wishes, so the child would come to court and tell the court that, unless the child refuses to participate in any court hearings and the court doesn't have to verify it. The application to re-enroll in the program, a young adult may leave and re-enter the program as many times as they wish during the qualifying period, which is before they turn 21 or age 22 with a documented disability. prior discharge is not a barrier to readmission if the other eligibility requirements are met. To re-enter the extended foster care program, the youth must submit an application to the CBC lead agency with proof of participating in a qualifying activity. There is supposed to be a designated staff to help the young adult with this application and obtaining the necessary documentation. The CBC lead agency has 10 business days to make a decision on re-entry. The clock starts ticking from the date the completed application is received. If the child is readmitted to extended foster care, CLS should petition the court for reinstatement of jurisdiction. If the decision is to deny the application for re-enrollment, the CBC lead agency needs to send the young adult a notice of denial and an application for aftercare services. Young adult may appeal the determination of ineligibility to remain in extended foster care, and that is found in 39.6.21.51, subsection 9. And that's extended foster care. I'm going to hand it off to Lena.
All right, I'm going to be talking about PESS. PESS stands for Post-Secondary Education Services and Support. This is actually money that a young adult can receive for college. This is in addition to any Bright Future scholarships, any additional private scholarships they may get, and also Pell Grants and fee exemptions. If they age out of foster care and they're exempted from paying tuition, this is all in addition to that. So in order to qualify for PESS, a young adult needs to apply, and they apply through the community-based care agency. The qualifications are the young adult must have spent at least 6 months in licensed care before his or her 18th birthday. They must have a high school diploma or a GED. They must have been admitted as a full-time student in a college or a part-time student if they have a disability. This is for young adults between the ages of 18 and 23 years old. So even if your child or even if the young adult at 17 has gotten their GED and has enrolled in college, they're not eligible for PESS until they reach 18. In addition, the young adult needs to have applied for any scholarships that are available. Specifically, they need to have filled out and completed FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid. This application, it has to be completed and error-free. They can't just say, I submitted it. No, it needs to be with no other questions, and it needs to be complete. So if they qualify for PESS, the amount they receive is $1,256. That is way more than I received when I was in college. So it's really good for our young adults to know that this is available, and it's quite easy to meet the qualifications if they're just going to school, honestly. The last thing is that they must have been living in licensed care on their 18th birthday or currently living in foster care, or that they were 16 years old and adopted from foster care or placed with a court-approved guardian after spending 6 months in care within 12 months immediately preceding such adoption or placement. That can get really, really confusing. The statute here is 49.1451, subsection 2. While they're doing PESS, a young adult can also be in extended foster care. They can do both. But if they're doing extended foster care, then the money is less because they have to pay the fees for the foster care family, and the foster care family would administer their money or be the people that receive it and then give it to the child after they get their sum. If the child goes out and lives on their own in a dorm, then the dependency case manager will administer the money to the child up to a point where the dependency case manager and the child believe that the child is responsible enough to receive directly. And at least in Brevard County, the child will need to be in using direct deposit in order for the money to go directly into their bank account. Now, and one last thing is that the child needs to agree to allow the community-based care agency access to their school records, because they need to have a minimum requirement, a minimum GPA, in order to be eligible for PESS every semester. So they have to give them access, or at least let them see their grades every semester. If their grades go down and they no longer meet the requirements for PESS, then they will be kicked out of PESS. However, they can continue going to college, pull their grades up the following semester, and reapply to enter PESS again. I believe this is only a one-time allowance, but if they mess up one time, they can fix it and come back in. The young adult would apply through the community-based care agency, who will then let them know if they're eligible or not. If they're denied, they can always appeal that decision. Again, they would apply with the community-based agency, but that appeal would then go to the Department of Children and Families, who would then determine whether they qualify or not. So that is it for PESS. I want to briefly touch upon aftercare services. Aftercare services is also under the same statute. It's subsection 3. This is available for young adults who are 18 through 23. They are for young adults who are not in extended foster care, who are not in PESS, so they're not receiving any services, but they need temporary assistance, including mentoring, tutoring, mental health services, including substance abuse counseling, life skills, parenting classes, job and career training, counselor consultations, and also some temporary financial assistance, which includes money for education supplies, for transportation expenses, like if their car broke down and they need some help, security deposits for rent and utilities, furnishings for a new home, and most importantly, if a child is out there and has nowhere to go, this is to prevent homelessness. So the community-based agency has to act or are required to act expeditiously in order for the child not to be homeless. So that is it on my end.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Thompson. I'm going to discuss the judicial reviews and key events during the year leading up to the child's 18th birthday, starting with the 17-year-old judicial review, which must occur within 90 days after the child's 17th birthday. At that judicial review, there are several important items that need to be or should be addressed by the court to prepare the child for adulthood. First, the court should address the entry of an order or any orders removing the disabilities of non-age relating to bank accounts, residential leases, utility services, and car insurance for any of these disabilities that the court finds is in the child's best interest to remove. The child should be given the opportunity to address the court at this judicial review with any information relevant to the child's best interest, and particularly in relation to independent living transition services. There must be written verification within the state's judicial review social study report that the child has received certain information and documentation that's outlined in 39701-3A, subsections 1 to 15. That list is delineated in the statute, so I won't read that here today. In addition, an updated case plan must be provided. The state is required to provide the court with an updated case plan that includes specific information related to the independent living skills that the child has acquired since the child's 13th birthday or since the date that the child came into foster care, whichever came later. There are also special requirements when addressing children who may meet the requirements for an appointment of a guardian pursuant to Chapter 744 or a guardian advocate pursuant to Chapter 393.12. Prior to the 17-year-old judicial review, the updated case plan that I mentioned a few moments ago, when you're dealing with a child who may qualify for a guardian or guardian advocate, that case plan is supposed to be developed in a face-to-face conference with the child, if appropriate, with the attorney ad litem for the child, with the guardian ad litem, the temporary custodian, and the parent if parental rights have not been terminated. At the time of the 17-year-old judicial review, if the court determines pursuant to Chapter 744 that there's a good faith basis to believe that the child qualifies for appointment of a guardian advocate, limited guardian, or plenary guardian for the child, and that no less restrictive decision-making assistance will meet the child's needs, there are certain requirements that are triggered by that finding. The department is required to complete a multidisciplinary report, which must include but is not limited to psychosocial evaluation and educational report if such report has not been completed within the previous 2 years. This documentation is very important for filings that may be necessary in a 744 or 393 action. The department shall identify one or more of the individuals who are willing to serve as the guardian advocate pursuant to 393.12 or as the plenary or limited guardian pursuant to Chapter 744. After the initial judicial review, when you're dealing with a child who may qualify for a guardian or guardian advocate, proceedings may begin to try to secure a guardian or guardian advocate for the child within the first 180 days after the child's 17th birthday. That is supposed to take place in a separate proceeding in the court division with jurisdiction over guardianship matters and pursuant to Chapter 744. The legislature encourages the use of pro bono representation to initiate the proceedings under that section. In the event that another interested party or participant initiates proceedings for the appointment of a guardian advocate, plenary guardian, or limited guardian for the child, the department is required to provide all necessary documentation and information to the petitioner to complete a petition under Chapter 393.12 or Chapter 744 within 45 days after the first judicial review hearing after the child's 17th birthday. Proceedings seeking a guardian advocate or appointment of a limited guardian are going to occur in the court division with jurisdiction over guardianship matters. There are consequences outlined in the statute, specifically in 39.701.3, if the department fails to meet the obligations required in 39.701.3. The court finds that the judicial review hearing that the department has not met its obligations to the child as stated in this part. In a written case plan or in the provision of independent living services, the court may issue an order directing the department to show cause as to why it has not done so. The department cannot justify its noncompliance. The court may give the department 30 days within which to comply. The department fails to comply within 30 days. The court may hold the department in contempt. After that judicial review hearing and within or before, as long as it occurs within the 180-day period after a child reaches 17 years of old, 17 years old, transition planning must take place for the child. The necessary individuals involved in transition planning for the child are the department, the community-based care provider, the caregiver, and any other individual with whom the child would like to include. This is supposed to assist the child in developing a transition plan, which would outline specific and address specific options for the child to use in obtaining necessary services such as housing, health insurance, education, a driver's license, and workforce support and employment services. The transition plan must also consider establishing and maintaining naturally occurring mentoring relationships and other personal support services. It may be as detailed as the child chooses. In developing the transition plan, the department and the community-based care provider are required to provide the child with documentation required pursuant to 39701 subsection 3 and coordinate the transition plan with the independent living provisions in the case plan, and for a child with disabilities, with the individuals with Disabilities Education Act transition plan. The department and the child shall schedule a time and date and place for the meeting to occur at a place, date, and time that is convenient for the child and any individual with whom the child would like to include in the meeting. The meeting must be conducted in the child's primary language. The transition plan shall be reviewed periodically with the child, the department, and other individuals of the child's choice and updated when necessary before each judicial review so long as the child or young adult remains in care. The transition plan must be approved by the court before the child's 18th birthday and must be attached to the case plan and updated before each judicial review. At the final judicial review before a child turns 18, the court shall address whether a child plans to remain in foster care, if the child is in foster care at that time, and if so, ensure the child's transition plan includes a plan for meeting one or more of the criteria outlined in 39.6251 regarding extended foster care. At this point in time, that's all I have. I'm going to turn it over to Suzanne Taylor.
Hi, everybody. My name is Suzanne Taylor. I'm going to talk about the Keys to Independence program, and I'm not going to talk for very long because there's an excellent website, and it's really too easy for y'all to check and see if I said things right, but the keystoindependencesl.org website is wonderful. It contains all kinds of information. It gives you history. It gives you the application, the actual application that you need to fill out. It gives you information. It gives you estimates of how much money. It gives you a timeline of how the child applies for his or her driver's license, which I have a 16-year-old at home, and I can tell you that even though I didn't use this program, it was helpful to explaining the steps that it takes for a child or a young person to get a driver's license and a permit in the state of Florida. So it's an excellent website, even if you're not using the Keys to Independence program. But basically, Keys to Independence, and you probably know as much about it as I do, because we've heard a lot about it the last 2 years, but Keys to Independence basically is a pot of money to pay for or reimburse foster parent, or the caregiver, I should say, for any expenses used to help a young adult in our system get a driver's license. It includes all kinds of things. It includes license fees, course fees, insurance. It even includes the deductible if the youth is in an accident. The most important thing about the program to remember, I guess, is the website, because it gives you everything that you, if you don't know it, you'll be able to find it on the website. But generally, to be involved in the program, the youth has to be between 15 and 21 years old, which tracks how the age of the child who's not in care getting a driver's license as well. The one knock on that website, I have to say, is it didn't appear to have been updated since the new program was approved, I think, back in July. It used to be just kids in licensed foster care. Now it's all kids. It's expanded to include relative and non-relative placements, but they hadn't updated the website last week when I last looked. But the other, it's a lot of common sense. The caregiver has to use the prudent parent standard for normalcy for the child to determine whether the child can participate in the program. They have to give their approval. The child has to give his or her approval. And the child has to obviously comply with all the driving courses and requirements of the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. Two other things I'll mention. One is that there's another website. It's called, and if you look at the flyer that I attached, very bottom, it has the keystoindependencesl.org, and it also says it has info@keystoindependence.org. I don't know if that's a mistake or not, because it might be because it's missing the FL. But there is a keystoindependence.org, which is a website that talks about the program nationally. It talks and compares the different states that utilize this program. I think it's just Florida, and there was one other state that I can't remember. But it's not many states yet, at least included on that website. The only thing, other thing I'd like to mention is that someone mentioned, as one of my coworkers, I forget which one it was, but someone mentioned that it's a good thing to check the 17-year-old Judicial Review Social Study Report. I don't know if Maria just mentioned it. I think Lena mentioned it earlier, but to make sure that there's information on there for that child about this program to see if they qualify or if they're utilizing it or if that's something that's been missed. That's really all I have. If that's and that's